Marty Beal started as a state probation and parole officer in 1969. In 1978, he was elected president of Ask Me Council 24. He then became executive director of the Wisconsin State Employees Union, which made him the top negotiator for state employees who are union members. But he's retiring, and oh, the changes he has seen in recent years. Marty Beal, thanks for stopping in.
Well, thanks for having me, Steve. It's always a privilege to be on your show.
Thank you. You have been a union member for about 40 years?
Almost 40 years.
Almost 40 years, yeah. And a leader for 30 plus of those.
Right.
I think you took your first, you were elected to your first union leadership role in 1973.
Yeah, I was union local union president of the social services unit, which represented probation and parole and social workers and those kinds of folks, a brand new union for them. We came up in the old days of Lawton and Cabista, mm-hmm. you know, when they were still involved, and learned a lot from the leaders back then, and I just kind of worked my way up through the leadership of the union.
Now, you're not from Wisconsin. You came here to go to school?
I came here to go to Marquette. I did graduate from Marquette, as opposed to other people who did not, in 1968, and then I went to work for the state in 69 as a probation and parole agent. And things have, as you know, things have changed dramatically in those years, and even in the last 10 years. I mean, it's been incredible to watch the change. But, you know, I don't for one minute... am I sorry that I've done this, or that's been my career?
Well, talk about your legacy, Marty.
I mean, my legacy.
You saw the State Employees Union had how many workers when you joined it, and how many at its peak, and then we can talk about the recent drop in membership.
We had about 12,000 when I started, and over the period of time, we went to about 24,000. So we doubled over the years now. Since Act 10 has been in effect, we obviously have seen a dramatic drop in our membership because of all of the way Act 10 was composed and how the union, or what the union can do and can't do, and what value they can bring to state employees or not. So I've seen the ebb and the tide, or the ebb and the flow of membership, and I think back at some of those times. I started when. The first governor I really dealt with was Pat Lucey, mm-hmm. Historically, we had more difficult times with Democratic governors than we did Republicans until 5 years ago.
Okay.
Obviously.
Okay.
It's always been kind of it's always kind of a question in my mind is. Why did we have to struggle with mm-hmm. Marty Schreiber, Pat Lucey, Tony Earle,
Mr. Doyle,
even Jim Doyle a little bit in the beginning, versus the relationship we enjoyed with Tommy Thompson and McCallum, Lee Sherman Dreyfus. It's different worlds, really different worlds.
Well, what do you consider? What are you proudest of?
I'm proudest of the fact that over my tenure. That we were able to impact thousands and thousands of state employees' lives and their families, and made life just a little better for them, helped them get to the middle class, brought their salaries up to where they had to be, and that's a badge of pride that I wear, that I had a hand in doing that. And I didn't do that single-handedly. I mean, there were a lot of other people involved, but I provided the leadership, and I was involved in much of that. I tell people that. I'm a very fortunate person because I was able to get paid for my passion, my passion to workers' rights and social justice and equality in the work site. A lot of people believe in that, but they don't have the opportunity to be paid and do it every day. I did, which was an incredible privilege for me.
Let's go back to the 70s and 80s. When you asked state employees or public employees to join a union, what did you say would be the benefit, the upside?
Sure.
You pay X number of dues, but you would get what?
Yeah. The issue would be that if you would join the union, then we would bargain a contract for you. We would provide advocacy for you if you got in trouble at the job. We'd provide training for you. We would raise money for benefits. I mean, all those ancillary things. But the most important thing is the advocacy and the collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. We could deliver a contract, and in a lot of ways we were able to deliver really excellent contracts to state employees over those years, And that's only measured by when they were taken away in Act 10, when those collective bargaining agreements were basically null and void. People then began to understand the value of those contracts about what rules governs my work day, my work life. How do I transfer? How do I grieve?
Seniority and shift
all of that.
All that is part of a
correct. And so when that was gone, people were like, "Wow, we didn't realize that this was all in our contract. It was something we took for granted." And when it's gone, it created difficult work sites for state employees, which goes through today yet. I mean, we have work sites that are just horrible places for people, and certainly doesn't lead to providing good public service or employees' ability to do the job that they were hired to do.
Marty, I want to ask you about the traditional saying in the Capitol, which I've heard and you've heard, that unions like yours settled for less on the mm-hmm. wage side to get more on the benefit side. Mm-hmm. Number one, is that true? Number two, was that the pattern for decades, 80s, 90s, up through mm-hmm. the 2000s?
Mm-hmm. We always placed a higher value on our benefits, both in terms of expanding and or keeping them, and so when it came to the bargaining table, in a biennium where there were issues about funding our pension, for instance, we would take less amount in the pay and move the money over to pay the pension. And in a lot of ways, when we were actually paying the pension for a lot of years, basically we're able to help fully fund the pension system by doing it that way. Same with health insurance, we wanted to have affordable quality care. If that meant that we took less in a pay increase and paid more for that, or put that money into paying for that, we would do that. So it was always a delicate balance there. I mean, there were some years where everything was fine and we were able to bargain a contract. I can't remember, Steve, one contract though that we bargained in all those years that actually hit the inflationary rate. I mean, we were always around it, mm-hmm. a little bit below mm-hmm. it, but we never hit, if the inflation was 3%, we might have taken 2.2.
Yeah.
And it was, it was always a working partnership with the state as an employer. In bad times, when there were tight budgets, we understood that. We were able to convince our members that, all of us need to participate in this or it could result in layoffs or closures of institutions or program cuts. And over the years, our members understood that really very well. They understood that dynamic.
Your contracts built up some, you must admit, Marty, some pretty good fringe benefits. I mean, defined benefit pensions, mm-hmm. and for a long time, no contribution for health insurance. Mm-hmm. And finally, public employees can cash in unused sick leave. Mm-hmm. In retirement, only for health care.
Right.
Now, those are some pretty good benefits, aren't they?
They are. They're good benefits. They're not the best in the nation, but they were good benefits, yeah.
And this led, in 2010, to then-candidate Governor Walker saying, it's between the haves, the public employees, right. and the have-nots, right. you taxpayers who are paying for this benefits. Mm-hmm. When Governor Walker opened up that as a major campaign theme, your reaction, Marty?
My reaction was that I couldn't understand why this candidate for governor was into this divisive discussion. Because clearly we weren't the haves, and this whole thing about haves and have not. I mean, if you would have compared us at that time to other unionized workers, we were probably in the middle of all of that. Clearly, he and his comrades thought they could win political points by creating this divisiveness and basically negative picture of public employees. And not to give him any credit, he did that. I mean, we see that. We see that now. We see we still see the results, 5 years, five years later, of this divisive campaign that he set up, where, people are, families can't talk at Thanksgiving dinner, if one's a public employee. It was a very negative climate that was set up, and unfortunately, I think took away from a lot of the Wisconsin that we knew.
But it was a message that resonated mm-hmm. in 2010, in 2012, and sure. 2014.
Sure.
So do you think, were you surprised at the amount it resonated with voters in those three elections, sir?
I think what Walker did, he played on this. There was a seeds planted prior to Walker's campaign. We called it class envy kind of stuff. A lot of Republicans nationally were playing on this whole thing about why do you pay taxes so that public employees can, earn $100,000 a year driving a bus, or public employees have quality health care and you don't have quality health care. I always call it, this class envy. I tell a story about a Russian fable where a gentleman was walking down the road and a genie popped up and he found a lantern and the guy rubbed it and the genie said, well, you have one wish. And the guy said, well, my neighbor has a horse. And the genie said, well, I'll make sure you have a horse. He said, I want you to kill my neighbor's horse. And it was that kind of mentality, is that we wanted to, instead of everybody rising to where they should be, it was let's rip it away from people and bring them down to the lowest level. And, I didn't expect in 2009 or 10 that would really resonate the way it did, but clearly Walker and his folks, really put that out there, and it did ring. And we saw, the state kind of divide in half.
You mentioned the 2009-2010 session. It was Democratic Governor Jim Doyle then, right. And Democrats running both Senate and the Assembly.
Right.
Did they, did their policies, their budget, did they invite the GOP revolution then in November mm-hmm. of 2010 that gave us Governor Walker and the Republicans in control of both houses?
I don't know if they invited them. I don't know that... I think they could have been more, knowing Walker's history in Milwaukee County, knowing, what was beginning to unfold about, Tea Party and, these right-wing antics. I don't know that they were smart about that.
Okay.
And I think that they just continued doing business as usual. And I think that was the time to begin changing the way to do business.
You talk about the date that things began to change. How about this date? On December 15th of 2010, 17 union agreements were up. They had mm-hmm. already passed the Assembly. Mm-hmm. By the narrowest of margins, they were up in the Senate. Democratic mm-hmm. Senator Russ Decker, then the majority leader, Democratic Senator Jeff Blaley voted against them.
Mm-hmm.
Did that set the scene for Act 10?
Mm.
What's the linkage? Is there any linkage? Why did Decker vote against him?
Yeah, today I still ask that question.
He was a lame duck.
He was defeated. A lame duck. He had nothing to lose. It wasn't his history. I think that
he was a union
they took us for granted.
They took you for granted?
I think they took us for granted. I can't, prior to that, those contacts being rejected in the Senate, I had been contacted by a surrogate, a Walker,
mm-hmm.
Who said, "Can you, why don't you hold off on those contracts and let Scott Walker take care of them when he's governor?" And I said, "Absolutely not. We negotiated these contracts under Doyle, and we're going to go through the process. It's been long enough that we've been out there without these contracts." And that was about a week or 10 days before that happened in the Senate.
That December 15th
vote.
So
I don't know,
vote.
Right?
Okay.
I don't know if there was any discussion there. I don't know if Plaley talked to Walker, got cut some deal, then ended up getting him an appointment shortly thereafter.
He's now the State Railroad Commissioner.
Right. I don't know what Decker's deal was. We were very surprised, and obviously from some of my press quotes at the time, I was more than exasperated by what they had done.
You were really angry.
I was very angry.
You were one angry poked bear, It had those 17 contracts been approved,
mm-hmm.
could Governor Walker have passed Act 10, Marty?
Because
you would have had him locked up for a number of years,
we would have had him locked up for two, because the contracts were 2 years. I'm thinking that Walker had this as one of his base priorities, is to somehow do right to work for somebody. And, you know, the where he had control or power was public employees. So I'm thinking that we could have probably gotten maybe another 2 years, and then when those contracts came up, we would see Act 10 as we know it now.
Okay.
I mean, he made all sorts of comments, both sides. I mean, he was at the Oshkosh Northwestern and says that he's looking forward to bargaining contracts with the unions and an editorial board sitting before the election. But we also have the tape of him and the widow Hendricks and Jane's and Beloit saying, you know, don't worry, I'll get right to work. And we were the first to get right to work.
Well, okay, so Decker and Bailey, their votes means it's 16-16 in the Senate, which means those contracts, don't get ratified.
Right.
Then it is only a few weeks later that Walker introduces Act 10.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised at the scope of the changes that mm-hmm. he reached for and signed into law mm-hmm. in Act 10?
I was. We knew he was going to do something.
Yeah.
Something about our collective bargaining. But I don't know that anybody prior to him actually releasing the bill knew the width and breadth of what he was doing. This whole issue of Act 10 is not simply just taking away payroll deduction, and but when he takes away collective bargaining, what do I have then to offer to my members? You know, join me. I can't bargain a contract. I can bargain something that is capped off at the inflationary rate of CPI. But I can't bargain anything about your seniority or your transfer or your layoffs or what goes on in your work site. I can't get your labor management meetings, but you're going to pay me so much money a month to do that. And a little bit of advocacy that we do. I mean, that was kind of a perfect storm. I mean, this was pretty well thought out. Is that, you know, and if you remember after Act 10, he said we want the unions to stand on their value of what they provide to their members. Well, he took away everything we could do to provide anything of value for the most part. So in that context, he created this environment where people said, they lost money out of their pockets, on their furloughs, on their Doyle, you know, and then they took a hit in terms of no pay increase, increases in their pension, increases in their health insurance, and we had people in serious economic problems, and they're making decisions about, is it the house load or my union dues? And it was a very difficult time to watch that happen.
He billed that as good public policy.
Correct.
And again, going back to the haves and have-nots, and he wanted to put, you've heard him say it, local government leaders in control of their budget, and Act 10 did, mm-hmm. because we were in a fiscal crisis, so they were going to be dealing with less state aid. So he bills it as good public policy. My question for you is, was it pure political retribution?
Yeah, it was. And let me point out, let's talk about good public policy. And, you know, I only can think about this now because I'm in the process of going through my office and looking at a lot of stuff for the last 30 years as I retire here. But, you know, we, and I know other public employee unions, but I can speak about the state employees, we received national recognition and statewide recognition for, you know, collaborative efforts with this employer. You know, Tommy Thompson actually did a videotape that was nationally shown about the working relationship with his public sector unions. And in fact, went before the Puerto Rican legislature and said, you ought to pass collective bargaining for your workers here in Puerto Rico, because in Wisconsin it works well.
Mm-hmm.
And so through, you know, we functioned in a collaborative environment with the employer. And this whole issue about how Walker set up this kind of false scenario that the union comes to the bargaining table and says we want 22% pay increase, and the employer rolls over and says you got it, isn't the way it happens. And whether you're a county executive or mayor or the governor or whomever, I mean, you sit at the table with the union and we sit as equals and we talk about our issues.
Okay.
I mean, never once in the bargaining process we were in, did the employer ever roll over and say, you got what you came here to get. I mean, it was always hard fought, and we ended up somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
So this whole idea or image that Walker said is kind of established, that unions were, you know, would come in, pound on the table, and rip taxpayers off, never really was the scenario.
The incredible public protests, 125,000 people.
Yeah.
Did you ever think in that period between February and March, February was introduced, March it was approved, did you ever think you guys were going to win and either defeat Act 10 as it was proposed, mm-hmm. or force major changes that would make it more palatable?
Yeah, we did.
You thought?
We had several irons in the fire, if you will, you know, both in terms of court action and, you know, we were trying to work Republican legislators during that period of time prior to them passing Act 10, trying to get them to mitigate it. You know, Mary Bell and I stood up in front of 60,000 people and said publicly to Scott Walker, you know, we'll take your concessions on the pension and health insurance, mm-hmm. but don't take away our right to collectively bargain.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that would generate the public pressure needed to, so they would think again about what they were doing. And unfortunately, afterwards, in the aftermath of all this, you talk to, you know, I had the opportunity, or if that's the right term, to talk to several Republican legislators about what happened here. You know, for years you've been on our side, and all of a sudden now you threw the vote the other way. And there were a million reasons. You know, I was intimidated. I've never seen Mike Ellis be intimidated in my life, but he was intimidated by the governor, at least to claim that. Or, you know, if I didn't support this, I wouldn't get on committees. There was 1,000 reasons why,
mm-hmm.
none of them legitimate, about how this would develop a new relationship, if you will, between employees of the states and the legislature and the administrative branch.
If you had the Act 10, that February through March period, would you play it the same way? Would you play it differently?
I think I would. I would have even played it heavier.
Heavier.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What about the Democrats going to Illinois? Were you a part of that decision? Mm-hmm. Once they left, did you try to make overtures through them to try to change Act 10?
I personally wasn't part of the decision, but once they did go, I mean, there was contact made, as there was by Governor Walker and his people too, with the senators in Illinois. I lauded them. I thought what they did was a brave thing, innovative, obviously, and thought maybe that might have at least bring some sanity to a discussion table about restoring pieces of our collective bargaining. That didn't work either.
Okay. Is Governor Walker a masterful politician? And the reason I ask is he mm-hmm. won in 2010, he beat the recall in 2012, mm-hmm. and he just won re-election in 2014. How have you watched him? Now, did you have negotiations with him when he was in the Assembly from 93 through 2001?
We negotiated contracts when he was in the Assembly, and he voted for him.
Okay.
The only thing I had a lot of interaction with Walker when he was in the Assembly was that he was the crusader to privatize prisons. He was like the mouthpiece for the Corrections Corporation of America, and so representing a lot of workers in the state prisons. I mean, I had a lot of interaction with him and his folks about why this wasn't a good idea, and obviously we prevailed there because I didn't contract any prisons here
right.
in the state. But to your first question, do I think Walker is a masterful politician? No. I think Walker is a politician that you know, takes advantage of wherever his audience is at, you know, flip-flops on issues. You know, it's incredible to me to watch this guy say one thing 1 month and the opposite 2 months later. I don't call that masterful. I think he rode some hype. I think he rode the hysteria. I think he rode this whole Tea Party revolution. And the Dems were asleep at the wheel.
2012, the recall election.
Yeah.
Did people like you think you were going to turn him out of office?
Right? Yeah, I mean, we had 1 million people signing the petition.
How come he didn't?
That's a good question. I don't know. We worked very hard. We thought we had a very good opportunity to turn him out of office. You know, we can go back and quarterback that and, you know, kind of dissect it. And people talk about, did we have the right candidate? Did we have the right message? You know, should we have done this versus that? You know, that's all water over the dam. I thought when we hit the million signature mark that we stood a good chance of taking him out.
But he got more votes in the recall than he did in 2010.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about the Democratic Party. Does it not have the organization or the message or the candidates to do better in this state?
I think if there's one thing I have to say about the Democratic Party vis-a-vis the Republican Party is that it's obvious that the Republican Party has been working years and years and years about putting together a bench of candidates. You can see that. Take a look at what's going on across the street over there. You know, they've been involved in local races, school board races, county board races. They move their people through a cycle, an educational program, and all of a sudden, you know, here's a name you never heard before and wins a state assembly seat fairly significantly. The Dems, up until a couple of years ago, never did that. They just kind of took whoever came up. And people would say, yeah, he's a good guy or a nice woman, and they'd run that person. And I think that the Dems had issues with the kind of bench they had.
Have they got a stronger bench now?
I think they're developing that. But they're years behind.
Well, obviously. Who impresses you as potential candidates for governor?
For governor,
in
right now,
2018.
I can't tell you.
You can't name one?
No.
There's not one up and coming Democrat whose name you want to throw out as a potential good candidate.
The only one is Feingold, but he's running for the U.S. Senate.
U.S. Senate.
Right.
Okay. Are you sad that you can't name any up-and-coming promising Democrat?
Yeah, I am.
You are?
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
But I think that's indicative of the kind of work the Democrats have to do to get their house in order. You know, and I think if you ask that same question to a lot of Democratic voters, they give you the same answer. There's nobody out there. Who would it be? I don't know. I
mean, 5 years later, talk to me about the morale of public employees, state employees, public employees.
Mm-hmm.
How are they doing?
Not bad. Not very good. I mean, I describe state work sites as cesspools, and I'm not very far from the truth.
Are you talking prisons?
I'm talking across the board.
Cesspools?
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's talk with prisons. Prisons are so short-staffed, it's incredible. Overtime is off the charts. At Columbia Correctional Institution, they're working... those officers are working 12, 16-hour shifts. Part of the reason is that the working conditions are so bad, they can't retain people. People are leaving, retiring, and then they bring in 6, 8 people, brand-new people. They last 2 weeks. They quit. We're not going to work in this kind of a setting. They are not nice places.
Are prisons the worst example of your term cesspools, Marty?
I think most 24/7s. Prisons, we have a lot of overtime in our centers and mental health institutes. King Veterans Home, I mean, we actually had people working 3 16s a week and then 2 8s. You know, so people are working tremendous amounts of hours, but also with that incredible work schedule is that there's no value to what they do. When they try to talk to their supervisor, they try to talk to their warden, try to talk to the secretary of the department, they're turned away. They're told, like in corrections, I've got several emails where the secretary of corrections writes emails to workers who are raising issues saying, if you don't like this, you can go work somewhere else.
Go back to the Tommy era.
Yeah.
You used to have breakfast almost weekly with a corrections secretary, didn't you?
Oh, we had an incredible working relationship.
In fact, some of your members said you were too close to that corrections secretary.
Right, but we did a lot of things. And we did a lot of things collaboratively. You know, things were good in corrections. People were working schedules. People were compensated properly. Issues were dealt with, whether it was overcrowding or, you know, the new prisons that were built under Tommy. We did a lot of things collaboratively. I think that, you know, that kind of showed what happens when management and the union can work together. I mean, if we were in that scenario with, you know, having to build new prisons and changes going on in corrections today under Walker, it would be a whole different scenario, and it would be brutal.
Do you think Democrats are going to stay out of power because you can't name any promising candidates for governor? And the reapportionment maps won't be drawn until 2020 for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, I would hope that the Dems can make some gains in the legislature. I don't see them taking it back in the next two years, but make significant gains. I would hope that somehow we could get to a point of having some impact on reapportionment. Reapportionment, you know, has kind of created a lot of the political issues that we face today. You know, we need to have a fair way of drawing lines, and I think the only way to do that is if you have a party in power that's willing to talk with the other side and to actually commit themselves to drawing fair lines rather than political lines.
One impact of Act 10 has been the forced merger of the three AFSCME councils, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
24 and 48 and what other?
Council 40.
And now there's just one,
Council
correct?
32, correct.
And how many members does it have?
Probably about 14, 15,000.
14 or 15,000.
Mm-hmm.
We only have a few minutes left, so let's talk about, are you surprised? I want to ask the question this way. When union leaders nationally ask you about Scott Walker's arc and his being mentioned as a top-tier Republican mm-hmm. presidential candidate, Marty, tell me about Scott Walker. Mm-hmm. What do you say?
We do. We tell them exactly what Scott Walker has done to public employees. In the last couple of years, we spent a lot of time going around the country talking about to other public employee leadership around the country talking about the evils of Scott Walker. Now, I'm sure when Walker hears this, he says, you know, I said, you know, big unions are against me, but we're very candid and truthful with people who ask us about Scott Walker and what he's done here. How's he treated public employees? What does it mean? You know, we try to compare it to what it would mean in their state or in whatever public sector they've come from. You know, and I think, candidly, I think that this rise of Scott Walker to kind of the top tier, I mean, the air is going to go out of that balloon, I think, pretty soon. And
so you don't see him as a Republican presidential candidate nominee?
Well, I don't see him as a nominee, absolutely not.
Okay.
I see him playing around out there. I mean, you know, he can talk about his religion and ride his Harley and eat barbecue ribs, and he's having a good time while the rest of us here are suffering under his issues.
But he uses the victories in Act mm-hmm. 10 mm-hmm. against the union yeah. officials like you as a reason to emerge as a top-tier Republican yeah. presidential
candidate. And I don't think that plays with everybody in other states. It plays with the right wing, you know. But I don't think it plays with a whole majority of people. You know, I'm sure it doesn't play well in Minnesota. You know, Minnesota's, you know, stayed pretty progressive in the last elections. I'm sure it doesn't play well in some of the heartland in terms of, you know, Ohio or Pennsylvania, but it plays well to who he wants to play with is, you know, the religious right and the Tea Party folks who are all about looking for a savior.
But at some point, you think his presidential campaign hopes that balloon gets popped.
I believe it will be.
And so, who do you think will be the Republican nominee for president?
Probably George Bush, not
Jeb
George
Bush.
Jeb Bush.
And are you comfortable with Hillary being the far and away leader of the Democratic Party?
I think I'm not going to come out and say that Hillary is the candidate. I like to see this, the reality happening with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. I think that that discussion, the three of them having in a national, on the national stage, I think will be good. For the people.
So you're not pinning on or ready for Hillary Clinton
yet?
No,
you don't see it on here.
I don't see that.
No.
Talk about President Obama. Most mm-hmm. specifically, I find it interesting that Democratic Congressman Ron Kind mm-hmm. believes in the president's trade pacts, mm-hmm. Trans-Pacific Pact.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Pocan, who I talked to at the convention, mm-hmm. leading the charge against it. Mm-hmm. The president's trade pact, good or bad for Wisconsin
bad.
Workers? Bad why?
Bad. Let me just go back a bit. Ron Kind's support of trade pacts go way beyond Obama. I mean, he supported NAFTA in the Clinton years. And you know, it's something we scratch our head about in the labor movement. Why is Ron Kind on these trade? Because even his own sister, who worked for La Crosse Rubber Mills, I mean, was displaced because they moved the rubber mills to China. So, I mean, he's had personal experience in it, but he continues to be there in support of the trade pacts.
Is Kind no friend of labor, Marty?
He always has been, you know, and we've always tried to talk to him about his support of trade pacts, but I think this last time with the TPP, it'll be very difficult for labor to move behind him. I know that the Labor Council in La Crosse actually passed a resolution that really would be difficult for Ron Kind to get their support over there.
Okay.
I mean, you give the guy enough chances, when does it stop?
So are you afraid for jobs in Wisconsin if the Trans-Pacific?
I am certainly. I am very much.
Manufacturing jobs, but not public employee jobs.
Not public employee, but manufacturing jobs, which goes again to our economy. I mean, take a look at NAFTA. I mean, how many industrial jobs moved out of Milwaukee when NAFTA passed, or some of the other trade agreements? If we lose the manufacturing base, or the production base to across the seas or to Mexico or wherever that goes, I mean, it has a tremendous impact on our economy here. And I don't see anything that boosts what we lose in terms of those trade pacts for Wisconsin workers.
Has President Obama been, he's finishing his second term, has he been a good president for your issues?
I think on a lot of things he's been a good president. I think there's some issues like the trade pacts that, you know, we have issues with him on. But I think all in all, I think he's been a good president. I think, unfortunately, you know, there's 100 other factors that play when people look at and listen to Barack Obama. But I personally think that Barack Obama was a good president.
Okay. Let's end the interview this way. If you were asked to give advice to the Wisconsin Democratic Party, what would it be?
Spend as much time, energy, and resources in developing excellent candidates across the state.
If you were asked to give advice to the Wisconsin Republican Party, what would it be?
Get to reality.
Get to reality? Explain that.
I don't think they're dealing in terms of the Republican issues. I don't think that they are true Republican issues. They're political issues. I think that the Republicans need to get to a reality rather than make decisions about political issues.
Does that pendulum swing back to the Democrats or in Wisconsin, or is it a long way off?
I think it'll swing back. I don't know how long. It might be 6 or 8 years. It might be longer. But I think the Democrats, you know, ought to use that time to develop and candidates in leadership that can basically take Wisconsin back.
And finally, what's Marty Beal going to do in retirement?
Are you
going to run for office?
I'm not running for office.
You're not running for office?
Why would I run for office?
What are you going to do?
I'm going to do what I want to do. I've got a new grandchild, and I want to spend a lot of time with her. You know, and I also, you know, my whole life has been dedicated to social justice and economic dignity for workers, so I just can't walk away from that. I mean, I can't walk away from that and sit at the gas station in the morning and talk about whether the hail damaged the corn or not. I mean, so I really will continue to be involved at some level here in terms of workers' rights and social justice. And
we're going to see you at noon at the Solidarity Singers, which continue.
And you'll see me there. And you'll see me at rallies. You might even see me on the news.
Really?
Yeah.
How?
I'll get a hunt somehow.
You'll get a hunt? Well, you've had a pretty amazing career, correct?
I've had.
You've enjoyed it?
I've enjoyed it. I don't have anything that that disappoints me in my career, and I really appreciate the members that gave me this opportunity and the people who I had a chance to represent. It's been a remarkable ride, and the confidence and trust that thousands of state employees put in me, I mean, when you sit back and think about it, it's an incredible thing.
Does that outweigh the frustrations and the setbacks of the past 5 years?
In a way, it does. You know, the past 5 years hits you in the face because you're making this kind of decision about retiring when you really kind of, you know, you kind of look back and, you know, as you go through some of your stuff and you really see the accomplishments and the good times, and that really kind of balances the last 5 years out. You know, the last 5 years hasn't been easy for anybody in the labor movement. I think we need to take a look at the full picture here. I need to look at the full picture, and you really understand what you've done and how far things have come over the years.
Marty Beal, Executive Director of the Wisconsin State Employees Union. Thanks for coming in to talk about a pretty amazing career.
Well, thanks, Steve.
Good luck in retirement, Marty.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you.